You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of Around the Block, featured by Federal Prison Authority. I'm Bruce Cameron, along with Susan Giddings, offering you another great show today. Well, you know, we have clients that actually use our services for disciplinary issues. We'll talk about those maybe later, but I think today, Susan, we wanted to talk about the disciplinary process in the BOP, right?
Yeah, you know, periodically, actually a little bit with some regularity, we see it on the Facebook page. Mm-hmm. And, you know, by the time people are saying something, it's too late. The incident report's already there. Right. Sometimes when they're contacting us, they've already been to the seen the DHO and all of that. Mm-hmm. So we're on that backside of the appeal process. But thought it would be helpful just to kind of talk about some things. People have the mistaken impression that the due process rights, which are afforded under the Bureau's disciplinary system, is just like on the streets. It is not a criminal process. It's an administrative process. So, you're not afforded the same rights. The level of decision, right. You know, the what's the threshold? It's not beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not court. You can have a representative, but not
an outside lawyer.
Not an outside lawyer, not another inmate. You can't have a jailhouse lawyer with you. You know, so we thought it would be a good idea just to kind of go through that process. You know, every individual walking in the federal prison system goes through intake, gets an A&O handbook. They sign for that handbook. And in that handbook, it spells out the various incident reports. What's prohibited? And so when an individual starts out with, I didn't know that was against the rules. The first thing they're going to do is pull out that intake form and see where you sign for that A&O handbook. So what does that mean? You're signing for it. You need to be asking for it. So anyone who's out there who's, you know, kind of preparing to move to federal prison or is on that track, maybe you're dealing with some issues and you could be looking at federal prison. When you sign for receiving that admission and orientation handbook, you need to get it and you need to read it. It just doesn't get like thrown in with everything and thrown into your locker. You need to read it and you need to be aware of it because that's the first thing that's going to happen. They're going to go, says you received it. Did you read it? Oh, well, that's on you. You received it. The Bureau has the responsibility to provide you notice of the rules. If you don't take advantage of reading that handbook, it's on you. So that's first thing. excuse me. Very basic. There are four sets of levels, 100 to 400. 400 is the lowest level. I don't even know how frequently they actually write 400 level incident reports. It's like being unsanitary. A dirty cell, swearing at staff. If it's just swearing, using profane language, that can get you a 400. I don't know how often those actually happen. And then moving all the way up to at the 100 and 200 level, where you can have like criminal referrals. And we'll talk about that. But the process itself, there's an informal process. Where again, you get some low level 400 or 300 level incident report. It's your first time. You go see the lieutenant and they say, hey, you're going to do 10 hours of extra duty and we'll informally resolve it. You log your 10 hours of cleaning up on the rec yard or sweeping the sidewalks or whatever the case is, and they shred the incident report and it goes away. Then you have the UDC level, which is the Unit Disciplinary Committee, which is with your unit team. And then you move up to the for more serious 100 and 200 level incident reports, or for repetitive. If it is a third, fourth, fifth refusing an order incident report, you know, you could be looking at going to the DHO, the discipline hearing officer. That's when the due process rights are specifically afforded. You know, you get your incident report. That is your notice of the offense. But when it talks about the 24-hour notice to before your hearing, they're talking about the DHO hearing. When you do have the right to call witnesses, that's for the DHO hearing. You don't get to call witnesses at the UDC level. And why is that at the DHO level? Because there's liberty interest. You can lose good conduct time. You can face disciplinary segregation. As you know, you could be facing loss of time credits. Those are those kind of things. And that's why those additional levels are afforded the DHO level. Excuse me, a little tickle going on this afternoon. So if you read through the policy and you look at it, and I would encourage people to do that, you'll find a lot of ordinarily and usually, and that's language is because stuff happens in prison. So ordinarily an incident report is written within 24 hours of staff becoming aware of the incident. Ordinarily, crap happens. All that needs to be done is for them to document why they didn't. That's all. That doesn't give you grounds to go, oh, you have to expunge the incident report. It just doesn't work that way. Same thing with the lieutenant. You know, there's a lieutenant assigned an investigator. It's usually a lieutenant is assigned. That ordinarily happens within 24 hours. Investigation ordinarily happens within 24 hours. Again, all of those ordinaries. So let's suppose it's a 100 level incident report for a cell phone. Bruce and I have seen between the posts and phone calls and a couple of clients, we've had about 6 or 8 of them in the last couple of weeks. Because a cell phone is actually illegal, it will be referred to outside law enforcement. So what does that mean? Everything gets suspended. Everything holds. They send it out to outside law enforcement, FBI, local prosecutor's office. Yeah, your little light, I think, is, I don't know if we can hear you. I think you're not on, Bruce. Nope, you are not on. So it gets referred to outside law enforcement. And basically, everything is suspended until outside law enforcement says yay or nay on whether they're going to pursue prosecution. Once that incident report is released and the lieutenant can't take a statement from you, it'll be one of those things where the individual gets called into the office and is just given a copy. Hey, you're given an incident report. You're given your copy. That's it. You have charges against you. And the individual might start talking about defending. Like what was, and the lieutenant's going to stop you. I can't investigate. I can't talk to you once it's been referred to outside for outside prosecution. Once it's been released and outside prosecution, AUSA decides, U.S. Attorney's Office, FBI, they're not going to pursue criminal charges. Then it's released. Then the administrative process starts up again. Because if you remember, we said this is administrative, not criminal. So the administrative process has to be suspended in order to allow time for that criminal process to happen. In cases where an individual is prosecuted, that incident report is still released and that person still faces that administrative disciplinary action. And it's not considered double jeopardy. Again, it is the criminal process and the administrative process, and they're separate. Bruce, did you have a question? Are you back with us? Nope, he's not back with us. Oh, nope, he is dead in the water. So you guys are just going to have to listen to me today.
Am I there? I'm there now.
There you are. Wonderful.
I am. Okay. So the one thing I do want to mention is that as you continue to go down this road and explaining these things, which is fantastic, you know, we have clients that are going through the administrative remedy process, and this might be another show. Okay. This may not, we might not get to this today, but the administrative remedy process is where something has happened and you don't agree with what the BOP has decided. And so you're going to do this administrative remedy process. Now, what, you know, why would people like us be involved in that? Well, certainly, and we're going to lean into this. If you have a shorter sentence, you may not have the time, right? You may not have the time to go down the road of the administrative remedy process because it's very slow, depending on your situation. So just planting that seed real quick, but carry on. Yeah, just wanted to.
But the challenge is for individuals with shorter sentences is once the sanction has occurred, once there's been a sanctioning, it can't be informally resolved. Only the warden can overturn a UDC, only, or at least initially, and then it can go to the region. DHOs bypass the warden and go directly to the region in that administrative process. But once the sanctioning has happened, the window for informal is gone.
Right.
So
exactly.
But anyway, we'll keep moving. You know, you're now weirdly echoing at me, Bruce.
Who's echoing?
You are.
I am.
I mean, I can hear me on your mic. I don't know if you moved it closer to your speaker.
I might have.
I'm trying to adjust mine. Okay. Anyway, so again, as we started talking about this ordinarily process, ordinarily, usually things happen, and the only thing that Bureau staff member has to do along the process is explain the delay. And then we keep moving. It doesn't interfere with, it doesn't compromise the due process. It's just, hey, we had other things going on. I was in a penitentiary. Sometimes between incident happening on the yard and sorting everybody out and who was where and who was what and getting those reports written, sometimes that whole process took a couple days. Particularly if it was a larger scale incident and we were sorting groups out and who saw what and who was writing what and sorting through the memorandums and all that kind of stuff. Talking about what goes into the incident report. So the incident report is a two-sided form. The incarcerated person is going to get a copy just of that front side. They are not going to get a copy of the investigation. They're not going to get a copy of the evidence against them, right? Now, can they present evidence? Sure. But that happens at that DHO level. So if you're sitting in the lieutenant's office and they're saying they have an incident report for something and you know you weren't in that location and you say, hey, boss, you got to check the video. Okay. The lieutenant's going to make a note of that, right? On that investigation, I wasn't there. I was in my housing unit. I wasn't on the rec yard. If you look at the video, you're not going to find me anywhere there. I was in my housing unit. That is something that as an individual going through the process, you're going to talk to UDC about it. The lieutenants should be annotating that for the UDC. UDC should be annotating that for DHO. When you're looking at going to the DHO, unit team is going to ask you, do you have witnesses? Yes, I have 6 witnesses. Okay, and you start providing names and numbers. And here's the important part. What are they going to testify to? What evidence are they going to present? Bringing 16 character witnesses?
Not good.
Not going to help your cause. If two people saw you in the housing unit. Maybe it includes the unit officer. Hey, I was talking to Officer Smith in the unit when that alarm went off on the rec yard. He knows I was there. You can include all that information. And a lot of times in the individual making their statement to the lieutenant a lot of times is going to check that out and may stop the process altogether at that investigatory level. But if it moves along, you're going to have to provide that information. Because when it comes to the sanctioning, when it comes to, they don't find you guilty, they find you to have committed the prohibitive act. Again, administrative, not criminal. It's only in criminal court that you are found guilty. The Bureau only has to rely on that there is some fact that supports the charge.
For example, here we had a call yesterday. Hey, they wrote me up for a cell phone. Yeah, but it wasn't mine. They found it in my bed, but I wouldn't, you know.
It wasn't on my purse. I wasn't holding it. Doesn't matter. They only have to rely on some fact. And if there is mitigating facts, if there's conflicting facts, right?
Right.
Then it's the greater weight of the evidence. And I can promise you, if your only conflicting fact to the incident report is staff are lying and I'm telling the truth, you're going to be sanctioned. That can't be your only fact.
Yeah, you can't. That's not your argument.
We had another person call that the cell phone was concealed in the laundry bag, and the roomie, cellmate, took responsibility for it. And they didn't accept that. Why? Because, and it happens with regularity, one individual pays another to take responsibility because they have more to lose than the other guy does. So, sure, I'll take responsibility, and money shows up in the commissary account, or maybe just commissary is purchased, or whatever arrangements are made. So someone else copying to a cell phone that is in your area doesn't do any good. And it's not just a cell phone. Charging cords, SIM cards.
Oh, I wasn't. Yeah, my loved one is, she was pretty offended. Like, he wasn't written up for us. He didn't have a phone. He just had a charging cord.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of like paraphernalia for the phone, right?
It is. It is exactly paraphernalia to the phone. Had another situation where someone else was busted with a cell phone that was unlocked. And they went through the call log and cross-referenced it against the inmate telephone system. And everyone that they could match got an incident report, because you don't have to have possession of it right now.
Right.
Again, they became aware of you made a phone call, because who else wants to call your brother or your spouse other than you?
Right.
That's how that is. Remember, it said, it's just some fact, an outgoing call in a call log, an incoming call in a call log.
Right.
That matches that number matches one of your family members' numbers is enough. That is a fact that supports that at some point you had a phone in your, that phone in your possession.
You want to go over an out of bounds case, or let me set it up?
Out of bounds are so fun. Well, I was going to talk about the whole thing of how it escapes and in absentia.
Go ahead and do that. Do it.
Okay. So, and we ordinarily don't see this at the institution. Very few people actually walk away from or attempt to escape from an institution. I think there was one 3-year period that I was evaluating, and of all of the escapes, official escapes that occurred, most of them were either from the halfway house or en route to the halfway house. There was maybe about 30 or so. They were all from camps. So we really don't see escapes from, I'm not saying it can't happen, but the incidence of escape from secure facilities is almost non-existent. But when an escape occurs and the Bureau decides you are escaped, they put you on escape status. They will write an incident report. They will process it, and they will have a hearing that is done in absentia, meaning without you present.
You don't have to be there.
You don't have to be there.
Right.
They will sanction you, and they will just tuck it away. Now, whether you reappear hours later, now that wouldn't be a good example because then you'd be there. You reappear days later, weeks later, years later. Okay. They will do another hearing, but it is just a rehearing, and it's an opportunity for you to tell your side of the story.
Well, they do that. Like, we had a guy out in the community, and supposedly
y'all will do that with it. Yeah, absolutely.
Did they do it with him? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Once you are back in, if you have a hearing that is in absentia, once you come back into custody, there will be another rehearing. And that's where you get the opportunity. I had a case at Carswell. So I was on the female low security unit in the late 90s, early 2001.
Or you won south. North or
south? I was
south?
On 2 North.
2 North.
Right. 2 North, upstairs. Had a woman on my caseload who walked away from an institution, escaped from an institution in the 70s. And back when, I'm really dating myself, when Fort Worth was co-ed.
I know, inmates had keys and they were called residents.
Yes, way back when. And she disappeared and we had to do a rehearing for her. She was also an old law case because obviously it was from the 70s. So we had to get the parole commission involved and do all these things. And it was 20 years, more than that, but 20 plus years later, and we were doing a rehearing to affirm the sanctions that she had gotten. And that's just what that is. So, so let's talk about, we talked about the DHO and sanctioning when there's loss of good conduct time. And there's different types. If you actually read the policy, they talk about statutory time. They talk about vested and non-vested good conduct time. And those phrases may be a little odd sounding, particularly because, PLRA was introduced in 1996. So while there's probably still some folks out there from that are VICLA or SRA cases, they're few and far between.
Yeah.
But for those that are those old cases, they may have some vested time. So they have a smaller amount of good conduct time that's available to lose. Where PLRA cases, because they don't vest until they release, they can lose all of that time. So they can be sitting there with 300-500 days of good conduct time. And if they, kind of decide that they're done with behaving and they start getting repetitive misconduct, they can start taking those days as much as 41 days at a time and just start ticking away at it. And your release date just keeps moving.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, a lot of times that's the other thing, folks, that if you have a family member that's been written up or whatever, and if their dates change by 30 or 40 days, that means it's too late. The DHO sanction, it's been loaded and the time was removed. Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened when we were looking at cases. All of a sudden, we saw someone's date move by almost exactly a month.
Right.
And I went, that doesn't look right.
Must have been a naughty, a naughty person. Got in trouble.
Something happened.
Yep.
And you know, when, and it was particularly bad because it was the end of their sentence. You know, right. They were moving toward the end. Their paperwork is being done. In one case, they already have a designation date, and they can lose all of that. And so I just,
right.
It's just a difficult situation. And we know things happen.
Yeah. Or the infraction happens. They don't tell the family member. Somehow we find out, like, hey, this is what's going on. And they're just, some people are astonished. Like, well, why would that even impact his ability to get home confinement and all this and all these other benefits? Like, well, wait a minute. You know what I mean? We don't have
clear conduct. It has to do with following the rules.
Yeah.
If you can't follow the rules in the institution, how does the Bureau expect you to comply with?
Or something all that could influence the pattern risk and move it up. And that, if it moves up from outside of low.
Absolutely. A 100 level incident report impacts both custody and pattern. And if someone is right on the cusp there of the cut point.
Right. And we've talked about this before. People will confuse custody, security versus pattern. And but anyway, something that moves the pattern, you're jammed up. So
right.
Be careful. Yeah.
So when it comes to appealing stuff, well, one more thing I wanted to mention. We talked about cell phones. We talked about escapes. When it comes to your analysis, an individual, first off, the when becomes staff becomes aware is not when the UA exam is given. And it's not even the day it comes back. Because what the Bureau does is, because there is the possibility that the individual could be on medication that creates a false positive. So when your analysis comes back, the first thing that happens is it goes over to health services. Health services then reviews the individual's medical record, look at what medications they're currently on, and looks to see if there's any reason that they could legitimately have a false positive. And if there is that legitimate reason for a false positive, well, then misconduct hasn't happened, right? Because you're taking your medication as you're supposed to, and maybe the two together created some kind of weird outcome. Staff become aware when it's gone to health services, it's been cleared as, nope, there is no legitimate reason for this individual to have had a dirty UA. It then comes back to correctional services, and that's when the incident report is written, because it's at that point they are considered to have had become aware, and that's when everything starts happening. When it comes to challenging, an individual in challenging a dirty UA can present evidence that they think may impact it, have impacted, had created a false positive, but the DHO is not going to consider the lab. Like, you can't come back and say, oh, I read in the news that XYZ Labs is had a data breach, and this is the reason that I got a dirty UA. DHO is not even going to consider it. They're not even going to look at it. If you want to challenge because you believe...
Well,
go ahead.
I mean the levels. So in other words, the level that the inmate has to achieve to test positive is really high. What they'll do is they'll just move that up, right? To make sure that if they're dirty, they're dirty. It's not like
they
some
have
trace.
A threshold, right? Yes. I mean, it's and the Bureau standard is not the same as you might see on the street.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
I mean, it's not like grossly different, but it is different. They have within the DHOs have within their standard. Same thing goes for breathalyzers. You know, it has to be at a certain threshold before it is considered hot. But as the individual challenging their that incident report, questioning the laboratory's process is a non-starter.
Right.
So, like, don't waste your time. Started talking about, we mentioned a little bit about those due process rights. What are you entitled to? You are entitled to notice. That's the incident report itself, right? And then when you go to UDC, your unit team, when they refer you to DHO, they're going to fill out the official form that says this is notice. Okay. They're going to give you that opportunity to have witnesses. They're going to give you that opportunity for staff rep. Who can be a staff representative? Anybody not in the process. So if I'm your case manager and I'm sitting on the UDC, I can't be your staff rep. If I'm the officer that wrote it, I can't be your staff rep. So it has to be someone that's a neutral third party. What does a staff rep do? They're going to talk to you and you're going to say, listen, all you got to do is go look at the video. I was in my housing unit. I was not on the rec yard. Staff rep should go look at the video.
Right.
Right. If you have someone to talk to, you can talk to Officer Jones. He saw me. You should go talk to Officer Jones. Now, hopefully, if it's something that plain and simple, it's been resolved at the investigatory process. But sometimes it's not, okay? But that's what your staff rep is there.
The difference staff between a 200 series fight and a 100 series assault, tiebreaker type stuff, yeah.
Yeah. So it's important if for your staff rep, and the staff know, they get trained every year through annual training. The DHOs review with all staff members what their responsibilities are. It is not their job to get you out of being sanctioned.
Right.
It is their job to make sure that your due process rights are adhered to. So again, they're not going to be the PI. If you say, hey, go interview, you can talk to my Sally and you can talk to Officer Jones and you can look at the camera. Well, then they should be doing that.
Exactly.
When you come to the actual hearing with the DHO, you don't get to interview your witnesses. The DHO will ask the questions. And there are times the DHO might have you step out of the room to interview a witness separately. DHO can use confidential informants. You are not going to be told who they are. You're not going to be in the room. I mean, that's the whole reason they're called confidential informants. Want to make sure I have all my notes here. I prepared today. Make sure I had covered everything. Okay. When the hearing is over and you get sanctioned and you go through the process, you're going to get a DHO report. That DHO report is going to include the advising of rights. During the hearing, the DHO is going to re-advise you of your rights. Were you given an opportunity to call witnesses? I says you didn't want any. Is that correct? Yes, it is. Says you wanted a staff rep or you didn't want a staff rep. Oh, that's one of the things I forgot. If you call a staff rep, ask for a staff rep, and for whatever reason that staff rep is not available on that day, you have the option of selecting another staff rep, moving forward with the process without a staff rep, or postponing your hearing until that staff rep is back. You know, if the staff rep is on annual leave, is on vacation, or is in training that week, you can postpone it. That's your call. But within this, the report itself, it's going to cover the advising of rights. It's going to cover what was the evidence relied on. It's going to cover their decision, the sanctions imposed, and the basis for the sanction. And those are blocked out. And you're going to receive a copy of that report. Again, you're not going to receive the investigation. Right. You're not necessarily going to receive all of the evidence against you. You're not going to get a copy of video. If they relied on video to put you in the place in whatever the incident was, if there was some kind of demonstration on the yard and you were identified from the video and there is no other contrary information that says you weren't there, again,
and
fact.
Right. And if you're FSA eligible and if you're spending time in the SHU under administrative detention, you're still okay until it turns into DS time, right?
Correct. DS time is by definition non-programming time. So when it comes to the appeal process, whether the appeal authority, the review authority is the warden or the region, they are looking at specific things, and I actually pulled the policy so I'd have it in front of me. They are reviewing whether the UDC or the DHO substantially complied with the regulations, whether the decisions were based on a fax. If there was conflicting evidence, was the decision based on the greater weight of the evidence, and whether the appropriate sanction was imposed or the severity level for the severity level of the prohibitive act and other relevant circumstances. It is not, a review authority is not going to consider or should not consider if, well, I wouldn't have done it. If I had been the DHO, I probably wouldn't have done that. They don't have to. They're not supposed to. They're only reviewing, did the disciplinary officer consider the facts and make a decision? And if there was, and again, we go back to that greater weight of the evidence. What is the greater weight of the evidence? That's like 50% plus one. Mm-hmm. Probably not even plus one. It's just, did the scales tip in one direction or the other? And that's a kind of a hard thing for folks. I mean, we've had these conversations with individuals before, and they're like, but I was, you know, it wasn't mine. It wasn't on my person. It was just somebody, they left it on my bed and they meant to leave it on my cellie's bed. Any cell phone, any contraband found in a cell is how both people are held accountable to it. Now, if it's in this one individual's locker, well, that's different. You know, they unlocked the locker to do a contraband search and they found it in there, do a cell search and found it in there. That's different because then that locker was locked. But if it's just there, both people are being held accountable to it.
Right.
And that's just the reality of it. Right. So, other thoughts, Bruce?
No, and I mean, these things happen a lot. And like you said, the way the Bureau scores these things versus the streets, there are some nuances and there are some differences. And, you know, as a family member or whatever, it could be frustrating because at the end of the day, the BOP has a whole lot of discretion here on how it handles these matters, these administrative matters. And it's backed up and continues to get backed up. There's been challenges over the years, but yet, in order to maintain the safe and orderly operation of the institution, that's a big old broom right there, you know.
Absolutely.
We have to, you betcha. And so, mm-hmm. You know,
something else people don't realize is the 24-hour rule can be waived. So if there's someone in, you know, for whatever reason, they're waiving their rights, they know, and they just need to move. They just want to move that process along because obviously the sooner they get through the process, the sooner they move on to whatever's next, whether it's a transfer, whether it's whatever. Some folks have, you know, kind of feel like, well, I'm hit. And if I just cooperate with the process along the way and I'm respectful, maybe the DHO won't be as hard on me. And to an extent, possibly, But under Prison Litigation Reform Act, there are mandatory sanctions with, in terms of loss of good conduct time. So you might dodge a bullet with DS time, and maybe you only get the forfeited good conduct time. And under PLRA, the DHO doesn't have that discretion. That is mandatory loss of time. And that's spelled out in the policy in terms of what's mandatory and what isn't. The other thing is the 24 hours. If a person is within releasing, if they were scheduled to be released, the Bureau can skip the 24 hours and go ahead and sanction you. And yes, you can appeal that, but it's spelled out in policy. That is an acceptable reason to
hold somebody up.
Yeah, hook somebody up, especially if it's serious. Now they might not mess with that with a 300 or 400 level, but if it was something serious and you're looking at loss of good conduct time, chances are they're just gonna go ahead and do it. And when you do appeal, like I said, a lot of folks will want to go and say, well, they didn't hit it on time. My UDC is supposed to be within 5 working days, and it was 8.
We had a situation where everything started all over again.
That was an appeal, and it's starting all over again.
Starting all over again.
And actually, the conversation we had, and this was an interesting one. I'm used to seeing rehearings. Right. In this case, it was a rewrite. And of course, you know, the individual was like, oh, because my due process rights were violated. And we're like, no, the incident report had a lot of extraneous, unrelated information. And, you know, part of his appeal was he wanted the evidence related to this extraneous stuff, which had nothing to do with the actual code that he was written up before. And, you know, we were like, no, we kind of think they're just telling him to rewrite it and cut that whole second section off. And because that is irrelevant, you weren't
right.
Written up for any of that. It was an escape situation. And the only relevant information was he was notified at one time to return immediately to the halfway house. And if he was where he was supposed to be, it wouldn't have taken him 3 hours to get back to the halfway house. That was enough.
Are they still doing escape flyers to the marshals?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Boy, I would hate that for me, because it's walkways, escape, and of course somebody would tell me what to do. Like, all right, you need to do the escape flyer. Like, all right then, you know what I mean? And
yeah.
And
I know from the institution side, so it was used to be totally frustrating. You'd call to verify that the individual arrived. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the receiving and discharge staff are following up. And the halfway house would say, oh, no, he didn't show up. And then you'd be like, oh, and you'd start doing everything. And 30 minutes later, somebody would show up and say, oh, sorry, our bad. He was actually upstairs asleep. The overnight person forgot to log him in. And you're like, so I know my staff used to get in the habit of waiting. They would start pulling everything together, but they would like, hey, can you like go and double check and then call me back? And I won't say it was every time, because there were times where folks didn't show up to the halfway house, but it happened frequently enough that it became part of our standard process was to ask, can you go double check?
Right.
Because
another
question I have,
like, and again, it's been a second, but I mean, like a 400 series incident report. I mean, shouldn't all that be either by informal resolution, if not the UDC? I mean, there's a 400.
Yeah. But you know, they keep track of how many informals you get.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
And even though it's not against you, they got that log.
Right.
And if you're sitting in front of the same lieutenant for the third or fourth time.
I got you on that next hit. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so you know, it's kind of like, you know, when we give our kid time out, right?
So on a repetitive thing.
Repetitive. And that's why I said, I don't even know that. I can't even remember the last time I saw a 400 level sanctioned incident report.
I mean, I'm going back in my memory, and I mean, where people are doing chores, waxing, buffing, trash, detail, this, that, you know,
and
doing all
camp,
kinds of work.
At a camp, you might see more of that.
Yeah.
You know, a camper is really honestly held to a higher standard. You know, you are in a non-secure correctional facility. Non-secure meaning there's not a fence around it, right? You're essentially on your honor to behave and serve your time, work, do whatever you need to do.
But we haven't gotten, I don't know why I brought that up for me. Thanks for listening. But yeah, I mean, the calls that you and I get are usually these 100 and 200 series.
Usually, I don't know that we've ever gotten a call.
I can't remember a 300 series.
Not even 300, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, again, you could get someone who actually loses good conduct time over a 300, but it's like their third in 12 months.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that's different.
That's such a slam dunk anyway. It's not even worth.
Right, right. No, I think that, you know, the bulk of what we have seen is the cell phones. And occasionally the escapes. And we had a case that actually on appeal, they did go back and they dropped him from escape to being
how much time do we have?
To being out of bounds or not following the conditions of the furlough. That's what it was.
We've had a couple. Maybe you and I had one, but prior associates of mine before Susan Giddings era, the guys that were unsafe, they get lit, you know, they get written up three times. Remember, I don't want to go out. I don't want to go out, that type of stuff. But that might be another show.
Right. Right. You know that, talking about protective custody cases.
Yes.
And in those cases, they were being written up for refusing an order.
Yep.
And you did the three, you did them 1 month apart.
Yep.
And then you transferred them.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a whole other show. But we did have that one case where on appeal they dropped it from an escape to a just a 300 level, and he ended up, once they got everything squared away, he ended up going back to halfway house.
Yep.
So I guess that was a good
thing.
All
right, two and a half minutes.
All right.
Today.
So you want to talk about the book for a second? Our books?
Please, yes.
Well, you have them, don't you have them right there?
Our books.
So Bruce and I do have two books, and he'll bring those over.
Look, Green Book. We have a person, had some other federal experience, and he's going to get designated to a minimum security place because we adhered to what was in the Green Book in a way. And of course, the First Step Act, this doesn't have the second edition badge.
That's not
on
the
it.
Second edition.
It's the first edition.
You want to make sure when you go onto Amazon.
They're selling out.
Yes, when you go onto Amazon, make sure you look for Unlocking Federal Time Credits, second edition.
Second edition.
You go to the first edition one will come up and it'll say it's out of print. So make sure you ask for the second edition. And the classification manual, the one on classification, the Green Book, if we have attorneys out there listening to us, those in pretrial, the first half of the book goes through the classification instrument as it is and just explains it, just like we do in time credits. We're just explaining it in plain language, giving examples so that, you know, everybody can understand how it works. The second half of the book is really targeting the pre-sentence investigation report and really targeting public defenders and private attorneys and their, you know, really their responsibility in making sure that PSR has good information. And of course, Bruce and I always believe in self-advocacy. So if you are sitting there and listening and you are going in this process, the $16.99 will well be worth making sure that
best money you ever spend.
Best
hands down,
you will ever spend, because let me tell
you,
probation officers write PSR for the courts, and attorneys are looking at the guideline information. They are not looking at the rest of the stuff that the Bureau looks at.
Absolutely.
That impacts classification, that impacts pattern, that impacts program eligibility.
All right. And with that, ding. Another fantastic show today. Thanks for listening and watching the show. You can see us on Apple Podcasts. All the shows are also archived on the LA Talk Radio site. Also, we have a YouTube channel, First Step Act on YouTube. Join our Facebook group, First Step Act, early release from federal prison. Post questions.
We just have 12,500 participants, members.
12,500 members in the Facebook. So thank you so much for your support. And until next week, we'll see you here next time on LA Talk Radio, Around the Block. Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye. See you later. Take care.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.